Gospel according to St. Matthew, the 13th chapter.
Glory to you, O Lord.
Jesus put before the crowds another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all the seeds, but when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until all of it was leavened. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure found in a field, which someone found and then hid. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and caught fish of every kind when it was full. They drew it ashore, sat down, and put the good into baskets, but threw out the bad. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all this? They answered, yes. And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
At the early service, just as we were settled down to have the moment of silence leading into the order for confession and forgiveness, 2 people on the street just outside our open doors decided to engage in a very loud verbal altercation with one another. It became to the point where it was even a bit disruptive to what was happening in here, but it made me think that as I heard the yelling and screaming back and forth, that that's what must feel like in the Oval Office right now. As the former chief of staff goes at the chief of communications in that office. Well, certainly there are things that we can pick up and cope with by chuckling about. It is also not unusual as we reflect upon what has been playing out in our nation this week to also be filled with fear and anxiety. And it is fear and anxiety that I want to speak to this morning. I want to take a look at the difference between fear and anxiety, and I'm appreciative to the work that Paul Tillich did in his book, The Courage to Be, in drawing the distinction between the two. When you look at fear, fear has a definite object, something that can be faced and analyzed, attacked, endured, and most likely overcome. And then courage can be understood as the capacity to face and overcome that fear. What courage can do is to take the fear produced by the object, however frightful it may be, and face the object head on with the hope of overcoming it through the strength of one's own initiative. Being able to address fear, we can say that we participate in the fear. By participating, we overcome the object that appears to have power over us. Now, the object of fear might be a particular object. For me, it's a fear of snakes. I don't even look at pictures of snakes. It might be a certain thing that might cause pain in your life. You don't want to get your flu shot each fall because you don't like the way that needle feels in your arm. It might be rooted in the fact that you're rejected by a person or another group, or the loss of an object. It even is surrounded and surrounds us when we see the death of somebody we know and love. Fear has an object. Courage then allows us to face that object and overcome it. Years ago, in serving in Ohio, I would take my then-finished eighth graders on a whitewater rafting trip. And we'd always start with this rafting company. It was a nice, calm, broad part of the river. No really any rapids at all. And the youth were in the boat, and the guide had talked us through everything we needed to do. And everyone was relaxed. But as we got close to the bend in the river, you could start hearing the roar of the water as the river narrowed and went over rocks and the rapids started to form. And one of the youth looked at the guide who was sitting in the back of the boat with her and said, "I'm afraid." And his response was, "Good." So he goes, first of all, if you are afraid, that means you respect the river. And if you respect what you fear, then you can develop the courage to overcome it because you know what you are facing. And she hunkered down, and she screamed a lot, and she used words taken out of religious context that we didn't hold her accountable for as we went down the river. She was so proud of herself because she overcame the fear and volunteered to go every year after that. That's fear, and it can be overcome. But anxiety is different than fear, Tillich writes. And the chief difference is that anxiety doesn't have an object. Anxiety really is this feeling we have when we face the possibility of an undoing of everything that has value and meaning to us. And in undoing everything that has value and meaning to us, it leads us to question even our very existence. Now, unlike fear, in which one can be active and to overcome the object of fear, anxiety doesn't allow our participation. And since anxiety doesn't have an object to which one can muster and focus one's courage, anxiety is really impossible to completely overcome by one's own initiative. I remember working with a member of my parish many years ago, and what she loved to do at the end of each day was, after her family had dinner, is that she would clean the kitchen up and wash the dishes and look out in her backyard and enjoy the sight of the birds and the flowers in the backyard, and to know that once the dishes were done and the kitchen was cleaned up, that she could just relax and really enjoy what the day had been like. But it was one night that, after her family had eaten and her son's friend picked him up to take him to a school activity, as she's washing the dishes and enjoying that moment of relaxation, the phone rings, and it's someone informing her there was a car crash and her son had been injured severely in the car crash. Now, the son pulled through and survived the crash, but what this member was facing is that from that point on, every time she started to wash the dishes, she was overcome with anxiety. And she couldn't name one particular thing causing the anxiety, but for her, it was the worry that something was going to undo this perfect world that she had created for herself. That's anxiety and how it plays a role in our lives. Now, there are different ways that we as human beings try to make sense of the anxiety and try to cope with the anxiety. Sometimes those differences are generational based on what people have lived through. But I think that the difference comes into being because we are really in the midst of a significant change in how we do and understand life. A lot of times that change is different between those born before 1965 and those born after 1965. The change is really the result in the fact that there's been a disintegration of something called authority. And remember that authority is that common ground upon which we can stand that determines for us what is right or wrong, beautiful or ugly, good or bad. And when there's a common authority, then we have in front of us ways of coping with our anxiety. But when there is no more common authority, then we don't have tools at our disposal to deal with anxiety. The first approach then to dealing with anxiety is to use morality as a solution. It's interesting, shaped primarily by the significant role that Christianity used to play, I want to highlight that, used to play in America, leading up to the fundamental question, which becomes, how will God judge my life? The ultimate concern that comes from asking that question is, when God judges my life, will I get into heaven? And that becomes the primary spiritual concern. Yet even with the assurances of God's forgiveness and the fundamental Protestant witness that God's power is what makes us acceptable to God, people still have at the depth of their souls this extreme notion that somehow God will treat them differently than everybody else. And that the promises that God makes to others don't apply to them. And as a result, God will find them guilty and God will condemn them. So out of this deeply rooted concern for guilt, there are two ways that morality plays out, two codes for morality. The first way is that the best way to do things, the most moral way to do things, is by showing love for one another. This way of showing love for one another is to defy any sense of negative judgment or moral demands that are placed upon people that judge them or evaluate them. We show love by bending or setting the rules aside out of concern for the person's well-being. The second way that morality may play out in this is that instead of setting the rules aside, instead there's this moral rigor that kicks in. And the self-satisfaction that comes from knowing that we have followed every rule that we have put out there. And we always need to remember that the rules about which we are most vehement are the ones that are easiest for us to follow. And we don't say much about the rules we can't follow because we can't follow them, so we can't be smug after following them. But in all cases, whether it's bending the rules or being legalistic, the anxiety of guilt lies in the background, and it breaks in again and again to human life because it raises the question of, did I get all the rules right? And in the end, despair becomes the outcome. What I think is ironic is the two moral approaches we have really align quite well with the way that we shape our political life right now. And when these moral approaches align with the way that we shape political life, then it becomes a fertile ground for fanaticism. Fanaticism deals with anxiety, and the anxiety by supposing to conquer and attack with disproportionate violence those who disagree and who demonstrate by their disagreement elements in the spiritual life of the fanatic, which he must suppress in himself. Because he must suppress them in himself, he must suppress them in others as well. His anxiety forces him to persecute dissenters. The problem is the weakness of those who are fanatical is that those whom he fights have a secret hold on him because he's never sure they're always going to be faithful to what he wants. And to this weakness, he and his group will always succumb. That's why I become concerned when religious schools of thought align themselves with political power. and chiefly why I become concerned when I see the evangelical part of Christianity claiming a special spot with the President of the United States. Because there immediately becomes the assumption that because there's a religious blessing upon it, everything that happens is right and faithful. And they forget the story that plays out in 1 Kings 22, where King Ahab, who was not one of the best leaders of the kingdom of God in those days, is surrounded by all the religious people and prophets who keep saying yes to him about everything. And there's only one religious person, the prophet, who has the courage to challenge him and say, "That's not what God is calling you to do." The other approach to understanding and addressing anxiety, other than with the immoral approach, is by trying to find meaning in life. You see, spiritual life tries to maintain itself as long as possible by clinging to the affirmations which are not yet undercut by what's happening, whether they're traditions or convictions or even emotional preferences. But sooner or later, that system of ideas and values upon which people grasp can't answer the necessary questions that people are asking, or the answers that they provide lose their meaning and don't have significance. As a result, then, there's a need for new spiritual creations to address the concerns that people have. The question that is asked in the search for meaning is this: what's the use? Why would I bother taking time to do all these things when in the end it's going to be like everything else and not play out the way it should? What shapes that feeling of meaninglessness are a number of factors that have played out in our social life. One is this perpetual need that we have, especially out of the moral side of the argument, this perpetual need for someone to be wrong, the judgmentalism that comes from that way of being in the world. It comes from seeing institutional failure, to see government not doing what government's supposed to do, seeing the church not being able to be the faithful group of people they claim to be. It's seen in what the future economy offers for people, that while it used to be that if one worked hard and did the right things, they would prosper later in life, there is not that assurance for those who are younger and working just as hard as there used to be for folks. It's found in the concern for the well-being of the environment and how we see really a lack of regard. That environment becomes nothing other than a product to be consumed instead of a gift of God's creation that Paul actually mentions in Romans 8 is crying out to be renewed and to be saved from human brokenness. This undoing has been found in the loss of safety, that one can't feel safe where one is anymore. It's found in this perpetual feedback loop of social media, where 24/7 you're always being informed whether people like what you have to say or offer or dislike it. And you can even nuance that from extreme ends of the spectrum. The search for a moral way to deal with anxiety, the search for approaching anxiety with meaning, unfortunately, they both end in the same place, which is despair, because they remind us that of our own initiative, there's nothing we can do to overcome what is coming at us in life. It was the Apostle Paul who wrote the letter to the Christians in the city of Rome, which was our second lesson today, who captures this despair in his letter. And the way he articulates it is that he believes that we live in a state of weakness. And this weakness for Paul is like looking into the darkness and not being able to see anything and believing that all is totally disintegrating around us. For him, it's a natural part of who we are as human beings. We cannot escape that interpretation of life. And what Paul does then in beautiful language is this captures what human beings do when they're overcome by their weakness and the darkness in which they look. He believes that we can all get to the point where we no longer have words to even describe the pain that we live in. All we can do, Paul says, all we can do is groan. We're so overwhelmed by what's happening to us. It's the groan of someone in physical pain. It's the groan of someone trapped or helpless or angry or overwhelmed, or all of them coming together at the same time. And then Paul goes on to say, and this groaning is a type of prayer. It's not the silent and private prayer of our personal devotional time. It's not the exquisite and eloquent words of prayer that you hear in corporate worship. But it's the moment when one agonizes in prayer. It's a lament for what has been lost, for what has failed. It's a longing for relief from the pain and anger. This prayer is like a deep wrestling with the pain of the world. The depth of the prayer, it goes so deep, it gets to the point where the pain and the brokenness in our lives and around us is so overwhelming that we cannot find words to articulate the dread that we experience. Paul doesn't leave us in that dark, despairing place. But what he tells you is that within each one of you, there is another presence at that place in your life. Within each of you is God's Spirit. The Spirit is the breath of God that brings life. The Spirit is the divine wind that protects and saves us. The Spirit of life makes us, adopts us as children of God. And he says God and the Spirit know each other intimately. And what Paul tells us is at the time of our groaning, when we're without words, the Spirit groans with us. In fact, the Spirit groans for us. And in that groaning, the Spirit puts into words our pain and lifts that to God's ears. But Paul puts in front of us a heart-searching God. And this God sees the secrets of our hearts laid open, raw and terrified. This God is moved by our pain. This God's own life, love, and energy are involved in the process of this agonizing prayer. And this God is heart searcher. This God who searches our hearts promises to set things right. See, this God accepts you for who you are without you being perfect. This God knows your humanity and your weakness, and yet still claims you and saves you. This God gives you a promise of a future that you long for but cannot imagine in your time of groaning. This future that God lays in front of us is at the core of what we call hope. For Paul, God gives us hope, and we live with hope, and hope is the vision of what God is finally going to make happen in this world. This hope is really an ache inside our hearts. It's an ache that comes from seeing and knowing how things really are, and yet believing that what they will be in the future will be so dramatically different than how they are now. Paul states earlier in Romans, in bringing hope into the argument, that suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, character produces hope. And then he makes this powerful assertion, hope never disappoints us. What allows Paul to make that claim that hope never disappoints us? It's this belief that God is for you. God is for you, for your salvation, for your forgiveness, for you to be brought into a new way of living. God is on your side. Paul, who so well knows what we do mentally whenever we have a claim like God is for us, then puts forth his most powerful statement. And the temptation for us is to say, God is for us, but I know there has to be something in this world that will undo God being for me. And Paul answers this way, there is nothing that can separate you from this God who is for you. Because God will not let that separation happen. The list that Paul puts in front of you, from natural disasters to all kinds of powers inside the world, even includes death and foreign armies attacking nations. It says none of these things can separate you from the love of God. When we claim that God is for us, then what we are claiming is that precisely at our point of weakness, at our times of uncertainty and our inability to make things work, that's when God is revealed to us. And in that revelation, we catch a glimpse of what God is going to do in the world. And that's the hope to which we cling. Amen.